Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now it's time for takeout on stories that we're following this week, or maybe I should say stories that we're following this year. Volunteers in North Dakota have filled their 1,000,000th sandbag as the Red River in Fargo is expected to crest this weekend at 38 feet. We're joined by Todd McDonald. He's a reporter at Prairie Public Broadcasting. He joins us from Fargo, and he actually rejoins us because, Todd, you were on the show a year ago, almost to the day, on this same story.
The catchphrase is the perfect storm. Late in the season, we saw not only a quick warming, we also saw rain. And another winter blizzard kind of came in and capped off everything and set us on that track for flood preparations.
So, Todd, without sounding flip about a situation which is obviously a crisis, is North Dakota every year hit by the perfect storm?
Not every year, no. Actually, this year we've actually had the ideal melt. It's been almost like a clockwork flood fight here.
Are you in what's considered to be dangerous floodplains there?
We're in what the National Weather Service describes as major flood category. But as far as danger, the meteorologists were hoping for a gentle spring, and it's been delivered to us in spades.
Okay, so what are the conditions in Fargo today?
Last I noticed, the river was at 35 feet, expected to crest at 38 feet sometime Sunday, probably early Sunday morning. And from there, you just wait, you monitor the levees until the water starts receding.
And how high can the river go before it becomes a true crisis?
We are prepared for 40 feet right now.
Okay.
So it gives up about 2 feet of freeboard, and if it starts rising, they will. They do have sandbags at the ready in case they do need to go higher, but it gets very costly for every additional foot you go.
Okay, well, you know, it begs the question as to why you would live in a floodplain in which any kind of particularly warm spring leads to danger of flooding.
Well, why does anybody want to live in the bottom of a glacial
lake? We love Fargo.
Lake?
Fargo's
exactly.
A great place.
It's
yeah.
The quality of life.
This isn't about Fargo, John. Don't make this about Fargo.
But, Todd, you're taking no chances there, right?
Oh, no, you never take chances.
But Todd, this leads to this program that the government there is involved in, which is actually to purchase some of these homes that are in the most dangerous locations.
That's been happening for over the years, yes. Ever since 1997, they started buying out homes that had, you know, walkout basements that faced the river and a nice little scenic view. But when the river does come up, you run a pretty significant chance of having some damage.
But you still, there's 3 dozen homeowners have taken government money. They've relocated. There are still some who won't move. Why? How come?
Do you enjoy the view?
They enjoy the view. Okay, Todd McDonald.
When you have deer walking through your backyard.
It's a beautiful place. Fargo is a beautiful place. Absolutely.
You bet.
Right now, though, the Red River in Fargo is rising rapidly, and they're hoping it doesn't rise above 40 feet. Todd McDonald's a reporter at Prairie Public Broadcasting.
I love this next takeout. Louise Story, Wall Street and Finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, is here in the studio. So Alan Greenspan is going to deliver a 48-page paper titled The Crisis, and it's his sort of examination of the causes of the financial meltdown. Some people would just shorten that paper to 2 words, Alan Greenspan, right? Does he have any credibility on this subject at this point, Louise?
Well, you know, John, he put out an autobiography in which he really defended his tenure. But there's people think it's kind of a big deal that in this paper he's admitting that he failed to see the housing bubble. Some people would say it's a no-brainer here that, you know, people failed to see the housing bubble. But he's admitting in this paper, he'll present it today at the Brookings Institute, that he failed to see it. What he is not admitting to, which people have accused him of, is he is not saying that his interest rate policy contributed. There's a lot of economists out there who are saying his low interest rates contributed, and he's still arguing that it didn't.
You know, it's interesting. You watched the hearings when Bernanke was in front
yep.
of the House. Ron Paul was asking Bernanke all about, were interest rates left too low too long,
yep.
referring to the Greenspan period. I was surprised that Bernanke basically said, well, we kind of don't know the answer to that.
Well,
the,
and you know, Bernanke,
is mixed there.
Bernanke was involved with the Fed when Greenspan mm-hmm. was running it. So Greenspan did give a very interesting alternative argument on the interest rates, which I hadn't seen before. It's in this paper. What he says is, that he controlled the short-term interest rates. You know, the Fed controls these overnight interest rates, and that the short-term interest rates are not what contributed. He says it's the low long-term interest rates that contributed, and those were influenced more by countries like China that became much bigger exporters than importers and which were saving so much money and buying U.S. treasuries. And so he's saying it's the long-term interest rates. That's not what I was over. It's not the ones that I controlled, the short-term interest rates.
Can he really make that argument, though? I mean, is it really the case that long-term interest rates are just set by the market and exporters overseas, and that short-term interest rates don't send a signal, especially if they're down for as long as they were under Greenspan, that it's time of easy money, and that's going to affect bubbles somewhere?
Well, you know, even some of Greenspan's closest friends, there's an economist at Stanford, John Taylor, who's very close with him, have criticized him and said he's wrong, that it was his interest rates. And I do think, like Bernanke said, that, you know, time will tell and historians will be dwelling this one for a long time.
You know, one of the things that Greenspan writes in this report that he's going to present at the Brookings Institution, as you say, I fear that preventing bubbles will in the end turn out to be infeasible. Assuaging their aftermath seems to be the best we can hope for. Now, if that's actually true, I mean, aside from being fairly self-justifying and self-rationalizing, I mean, that's sort of a disaster, because the Obama administration has basically committed itself to creating a regime of regulations that this will never happen again.
Well, he's refuting this. You know, there's this new council that's being created to have a Zeus-like power to look out for systemic risk and catch it. And he says he doesn't think you can find a bubble if it's coming up. What he says you should do is increase the capital and liquidity rules on the banks so that whenever the next bubble occurs, and it will occur, they'll be able to withstand it better, and we won't have such a big financial crisis that really kills the economy like this one did for at least a time.
So, lesson from Greenspan, the bubble is always where we're not looking. That's why you can never see it. Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Coming up,
it's an historic debate. It's a historic vote.
Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, showdown on health care reform set for as early as Sunday. Todd Zwillick joins us.